Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Good morning. It's Sunday, June the 10th, 2007, and this is Solder Smoke 62. It's a little bit later this morning, let's say 0711 Greenwich Mean Time. Going to start out with a quote of the week. This one comes from Farhan's new blog. We've been talking about the blog, and a link to it is on the Gadgeteer News site. I really encourage you guys to check it out. It's called Straight Key at Blogspot, or straightkey.blogspot, but like I said, the link is on the Gadgeteer News site. And Farhan has on the site, there's obviously a lot of information, I think, about homebrewing in general, but he put up a really great article about the design and construction of a direct conversion receiver that he built with his cousin. She was she needed a project for a portion of her engineering degree, and she was fortunate enough to have a cousin like Farhan who would help her design and build a direct conversion receiver. They call it the DC40. The article is really great because he goes into the different decisions that go into the design and construction of even what we consider a simple receiver. I like the fact that in the article Farhan points out that receivers represent a real special challenge for the radio amateur. I remember when I was getting started in home brewing, I frequently heard people say that, well, you know, hams can home brew their own transmitters, but receivers are really too difficult. You'll notice that going back into the, I guess, into the 30s and 40s, it was very common to find shacks in which the transmitter was home brewed, but the receiver was commercial. The thinking I believe was that it was just too difficult for hams to build really useful receivers. Of course, that's not true, but as Farhan points out, building a good and useful receiver it's difficult and it's a challenge. The quote that I want to share with you at the beginning here this morning is in the article, Farhan says that he had to respond to some questions from a friend who came in and saw them struggling with the construction of the new receiver, and the friend asked, why build it? Why build it when you can buy in a store a receiver that would do just as well? And Farhan gave a good answer, and I'll quote him here. It said, in his response, he said, because we human beings are fundamentally tool builders, we have an opposable thumb that allows us to grip the soldering iron. Well said, Farhan. Thanks for that, and thanks for the new blog. Farhan's blog has also, I think I mentioned this last week, caused me to again re-examine my test equipment thinking and my rather pathetic arsenal of test gear. One of the things that he discussed was the importance of a proper oscilloscope. And long-term listeners of Solder Smoke will probably remember my happiness when I picked up a ham egg oscilloscope at the one of the many Kempton Park radio rallies that I've attended over our time here in London. I like the scope. It's got a small footprint for a small shack. It's easy to operate. But Farhan's discussion about the bandwidth of the oscilloscopes really made me kind of think again about the usefulness of a scope of a 15 megahertz scope. I think the Hammag that I have is considered kind of a 15 megahertz scope. And I, reading Farhan's blog and some of the comments and emails that followed up his article on test gear, made me think about something important that I had forgotten. I had been thinking, well, you know, the 15 megahertz scope will be okay, because even with some losses, it'll read up to about 18 megahertz. And I don't usually build anything higher than that in frequency. Most of my construction is actually below 20 megahertz. So I figured, well, I'm okay. But of course I'm not. And as the email discussion pointed out, that if you, in my case, if I was to be looking at a signal coming out of one of my transmitters and thinking, oh wow, look, I've got a beautiful, perfect sine wave coming out, so my signal must be clean, because my trusty Hammag scope would show signs of distortion if there were any ugly parasitics or harmonics in there. Aha, but I'd be wrong, because of course some of the ugly parasitics and harmonics could be in there at frequencies way far beyond my pathetic 15 megahertz bandwidth limit, and they could be generating some real uglies and nasties just far beyond the attenuation range of the amplifiers in the scope. So guys, I think that indicates what my next test equipment acquisition is going to be, a more adequate scope, something Tektronix. Farhan's article has got me thinking about Tektronix, so I think I'll be in the market. I'll probably wait till I get to Rome. I have enough things to move around at this point. But anyway, thanks again to Farhan for that very enlightening blog posting on test gear. And I encourage you guys to take a look at the article on the DC 40 receiver. It's interesting and inspirational. What's happening on my bench here is in the test gear range. I told you that I was working on a current limited power supply. This project also had its roots in the Kempton Park Radio Rally. Tony Fishpool gave me his book on test gear for the radio amateur, and I've been looking at the current limited power supply that Tony and Graham have in their book. I realized that this would be a great help in preventing the release of smoke from components used in future projects. I should have had one like this a long time ago, but I just haven't. So I took a really beat up old power supply that I bought at Kempton Park, and after some effort to figure out the schematic, I just decided to gut the thing. So I've gutted it, and I'm using a circuit in Tony and Graham's book. It uses a chip. It's probably not the the most modern or up-to-date chip. It's the L200 current limiting regulator chip. It's got, I think, 5 or 6 pins coming out of it. And yesterday I mounted it on a PC board and configured it in a way so that I could use the cabinet of the box as the heat sink. I think it was kind of cool. I'll take a picture of it later on, but I basically, using Manhattan method, I constructed, in essence, a six little island pads on the edge of the PC board, so that I could put the chip. It's kind of it doesn't really, it's not really like a dual inline chip. It looks more like kind of an IRF 510 with the stub heatsink mount in it, so that I can just put the thing on the edge of the board and then just screw the heatsink tab into the top of the cabinet. I put a little bit of heatsink compound in there, and that hopefully will keep the thing running cool using the cabinet as the heatsink. It's been fun building this thing. It's kind of a this is probably my last homebrew project in London, and it was just neat to use the junk box parts and the box from the Kempton Park Rally, the circuit from Tony Fishpool, and an additional element went into it. I didn't like the color of the box. I'm not really particular in this regard, as anybody who looks at the pictures of my shack can tell. But this this thing was really exceedingly ugly. It was painted red and green, kind of like a Christmas tree power supply. I don't know, but I decided it needed to be painted, and my daughter Maria expressed an interest in painting the thing. So I had in the shack a can of black spray paint. So out we went to the garage, and Maria spray painted the thing for me. Did a pretty good job, and it was just fun to get the kids involved in the project. Billy over the years has been involved in many of my projects, and as a matter of fact, I don't think I mentioned this, but when we were talking about when I was building the power meter that Wes and Barb Larkin designed. The final connection, as I was putting it together, Billy was in the shack, and I called him over and I said, "Here, you do this one." And both my kids, by the way, can handle soldering iron. I think it's pretty good. Billy's 9, Maria's 7, and they can both solder. Anyway, Billy did the last connection on the power meter, and Maria painted the box for the power supply. And I think all this stuff kind of is a way of adding something to the equipment that we build. It's not only the use of junk box parts or parts given from friends or circuits from friends, or getting your kids involved in the project. And without getting too kind of mushy about this, but around the same time I came across a book that I read a long time ago. I think many of you guys have read it too. It's The Soul of a New Machine by Tracy Kidder. And I was just, the title reminded me that doing these kinds of things is a way of kind of adding some soul to the new machine that you're building. So by all means, have the kids help paint the box, or make your girlfriend solder the last connection in there, or something like that. good news on the home brewing front. Last week we had. We had Jimmy from Amateur Logic TV on. Got a lot of real positive feedback from that. People really enjoyed that show. And Jimmy was talking about his problems with the oscillator. He built an oscillator. I think he built it out of experimental methods. And he couldn't get the thing going. And guys, let's face it, we've all been there. You build this thing, you think it's going to work, and it just sits there and defies you. Well, after the show, I kind of thought of a few things that might help out, and a couple other guys thought of some things that might help out, and suggestions started coming through the fiber optic cable from around the world to Jimmy Shack there in Mississippi, and happy to report that they all helped out. It worked. I think it might have needed just a little bit of more feedback, maybe just a little bit more VCC. Maybe it needed to actually have a load hanging on the output, but whatever did it, because the thing is oscillating away, and Jim is experiencing the joy of homebrew oscillation over there in Mississippi. So fine business to Jim and to everybody who contributed to that one. We hope to have Jimmy and the boys from Amateur Logic on again. That was really a lot of fun. Mark Johnson, Moj Johnson, the musical maestro who has given us the world famous Sutter Smoke theme song, which I'm sure any moment will be appearing on the top 40 charts. It sent me an MP3 file of the Reverend George Dobbs talk at Dayton. And Mark sent this to me because he had mentioned that My Shack and Solder Smoke had featured in George's talk. George's talk is by the way, I've never been to Dayton, but every time Dayton and FDIM rolls around afterwards, there's lots of comments about how much people enjoy George's talk. He's got a great way of presenting things, and he really keeps the important part of home brewing and ham radio at the forefront of his presentation. So it's really great. That's one of the reasons I'm sad I never get to Dayton. But thanks to Mark for sending me out the MP3 file of George's talk, and I listened to it, and especially the part. Obviously, I focused in on the part where My Shack was presented. Apparently a picture of the M0HBR Solder Smoke studio was flashed up on the screen, and George said that it represents an example. It's something I had never heard of, but he said that My Shack is an example of wabi-sabi, and as far as I can tell from my brief listen to the presentation, it means sort of something being useful and appealing even in a state of almost extreme ugliness. That certainly describes my reaction to My Shack. I know it's ugly, but for me it's also kind of a work of a thing of beauty, as my old friend John, EI7BA, once described his antennas that way. I'm sure maybe his wives and neighbors wouldn't agree with that assessment, but you guys know what I mean. These things are technologically beautiful. So thanks to George for enlightening me about the wabi-sabi nature of my ham shack. I'm going to use that term. You know, I think it'll be very useful. It makes the whole thing just seem much more respectable. You know, it's very useful on those occasions where, you know, dinner guests or house guests somehow make their way into the shack, and you know, you can hear the gasp, the sounds of genuine horror. They act like they have just. You think that they might be thinking, "Uh-oh, this place looks a lot like the Unabomber's cabin up there in Montana." this is kind of a Ted Kaczynski kind of vibe to this whole place. But you can use the wabi-sabi terminology this will be especially useful with I guess sort of artistically inclined or posh gets guests, to use the British phrase. You could just look at them and say, "Oh, well, don't you know it's done up in wabi-sabi? Yes, it's the latest thing," and I'm sure that'll calm them down right away. Thanks again, George, for including the Solder Smoke and M0HBR London facilities in your Dayton presentation. Few things. One other thing I want to mention: the latest QST article, and I had it in my hand and it got away from me. But the latest edition of QST, or perhaps the one before that, has a really good sidebar article on simple tools to use to improve your metalwork capabilities, or to make it easier for you to put appropriately sized holes in metal boxes. And I thought it was a really good sidebar. And I apologize to the author for not being able to mention him by name. Somewhere else. But check it out. I thought it was really good, really practical, and he even includes the Mauser parts numbers for those who are interested in picking up the simple equipment and drill bits that he says will make your metalworking much less of a painful experience. It's always painful for me. all right. Listen, it's time to announce, and I guess this deserves some sound effects, a new Solder Smoke feature. You guys are familiar. We've had Mailbag from the beginning. We've had band sweep. We've had correspondence reports from Dayton. Oh, by the way, if anybody wants to be a correspondent at Friedrichshafen at the big Euro Ham Fest in the end of June, let me know. We are looking for correspondence. Anyway, today it's time to introduce yet another regular feature on Solder Smoke. We're going to call it Club Talk. Let's see. Peter, VK2 TPM down there in Sydney reports that there is a very large and active community of Solder Smoke fans and listeners in the Sydney area. Most of them are in the New South Wales Homebrew Group, which is a club that meets once a month at a McDonald's restaurant, specifically in the children's party room of the McDonald's restaurant. I'm not going to make any comments at all on how that might be the appropriate place for us to get together and talk about our technical toys. But anyway, apparently once a month they clear the kids out of the children's party room, and these heartless homebrewers go in there with their equipment and discuss it. It reminds me a lot of about a group that I was involved in, and I guess I'm still technically a member of, the the Nova QRP group, the Northern Virginia QRP group. We had a kind of similar meetings. We used to meet in a restaurant called Mama's up there in Northern Virginia, and it was a kind of once a month or once every other month deal, and it was just guys bringing in the their equipment and talking about it. So Peter, while they were having their last meeting, Peter had a recorder with him and did some interviews with members of the group. Now, I ask you guys to bear with us here, because it is a bit noisy. On the next edition, we might ask our correspondent down under to step out to the parking lot with the interviewees. But at least for this first episode, it's probably good that we have the raw kind of noisy McDonald's background noise there, because it gives you a sense of the excitement and the intensity that that these meetings have. I'm also really glad that among those interviewed, and everybody's interview is really interesting to hear about their projects. But Alan Yates, VK2ZAY, is in there, and Alan and I have been in contact for various homebrew projects going back many years. I first stumbled across Alan's page, and he was the one who alerted Billy and I to the Trivial Electric Motor. We went ahead and built one. It was one of our early and very successful homebrew projects together. We still have it here, and we still fire it up every once in a while. Alan's got some really great projects on his page, and it's good to finally have his voice coming through here on Solder Smoke. So thanks to Peter, thanks to everybody in the New South Wales homebrew group, and this is really great, because it's another pin on the map here in demonstrating the global reach of Solder Smoke. We've had now people from Europe, from North America, from India, and now Australia. I'll just pause now and put the interview on. It runs for about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back with Solder Smoke Mailbag.
Peter O'Connell, VK2MU. I'm the coordinator of the Amateur Radio New South Wales Radio Homebrewing Experimenters Group. We're at the Tuesday night informal get-together at Parramatta, upstairs at McDonald's. The 80-metre challenge is just that, it's a challenge.
Is it a competition?
No, it's not a competition. The main reason it's not a competition is that competitions, somebody wins. If you build your transmitter, you've won.
And how long has the group been meeting here, Peter?
A bit over a year. Since May 2006. Prior to that, for about 4 years, we met at... No, for about 3 years, we met at the Wallace Amateur Radio House of Parramatta.
Right.
We started probably 2001, having Sunday afternoon meetings. Then we started the Tuesday night meetings probably in 2003.
It's a brilliant location, beautifully decorated.
It is.
Burglar and everything here.
It costs us nothing.
And there's some cheap food downstairs.
Yes.
How many people are in involved in the group?
Probably about 15.
Hi, I'm John, VK2ASU. Okay, this is the Homebrew Group's 80 metre challenge transmitter.
So you better explain what that is.
It's a project that's been put forward at the start of this year to build a 20 watt AM single frequency transmitter with 20 watt output or better, spot frequency on 3.6864, inbuilt power supply, everything all in the one box. And it also has to have transmit receiver capabilities so that you can switch a relay to switch a receiver on. And this is my implementation of it.
Right, now we've got two boards here. What's this one?
Three. This is the board two. Starting with this one. So this is the oscillator. Two stages. One oscillator. Second one, which goes through a tuned circuit. It also has drive control, so I can control the amount of drive that goes to the next stage. The way I make my circuit boards is I take a hacksaw and literally hacksaw one side of dual side, double sided board into a series of little square pads about, what would that be?
A bit less than a centimetre.
Say a centimetre square, and you make it as big or as small as you want it.
So it's a bit like Manhattan pad, but you've cut the pads into the board rather than gluing them on the
rather top. Than individually fiddling around gluing them.
No,
yes,
that's good, yes.
I then sit down with the circuit and I've got the pattern drawn out on a sheet of paper, and you literally work all your components onto it, draw them on so that when it comes to actually populating the board, you don't even need the circuit anymore. You just literally, it says to put this here, you do it. You know. And most times the board works first up, but sometimes it doesn't. You've made a blue somewhere.
No, that would never happen.
No, never happen.
You release the smoke from something?
Yes, something like that.
And the third one?
The second one here.
Second one,
that's a little amplifier.
Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the final there. Once again, similar construction. I've got an IRF510 there with a heatsink on it. I've put a little earth barrier up between that and the previous stage, which is a 2N3866, which should give about a watt out. IRF510.
And how are you going to modulate this?
Okay, now this is not my idea. This is a Drew Diamond idea, and it's an absolute gem. The IRF510 needs a bias current. Now, the third board is literally an IC socket soldered directly to the back of a microphone socket.
Yep.
It's got an LM386 on there. That the output of the LM386, it'll be fed with 12 volts, and the output, it's really an op amp, is an LM386.
So it's got enough gain to go straight from a microphone to an AM modulator.
It goes straight from there to the bias.
Oh right,
to the bias. It modulates the bias.
How much voltage do you need on the bias?
Well, this is sitting here at 6 volts in the middle with no signal.
Yeah.
And as you modulate it with sound, the voltage goes up and down.
Right.
You feed that to the actual bias circuit of the IRF510. According to Drew, you need precious little power going in there.
It sounds too good to be true. What's the drawback?
We'll see when I put it all together and put some voltage on it.
Something, surely.
Well, the beauty is that you don't have to modulate the power into the final stage, which is usually the way people go.
Yeah.
You're just modulating the bias. So virtually microwatts produce
Hello, I'm Alan Yates, VK2ZAY, home brewer.
Extraordinaire. Make something every week.
I try to build something every weekend, just, you know, keep my hand in, because I spend most of my time behind a computer during the day, so it's a bit of a break for me.
So what have you got here?
This is the Fredbox, as mentioned on Solder Smoke. I've actually been in contact now with Roger, the bloke that originally came up with it, and we've exchanged some designs for other things, so I haven't even finished this and we're already talking about the next project.
Well, tell us what it is.
Alright, it's a VHF AM transmitter. It puts out about 40 milliwatts PEP, so about 10 milliwatts carrier, and it has a super regenerative detector, which is what I'm just about to plug in, and with any luck it might actually work.
Now, just explain your construction technique. It's a very compact technique that you use.
Yeah, everyone says the build stop too small. It's basically a mixture of a Manhattan and ugly. I use a nibbling tool to make little pads that I then glue down, you know, super glue or whatever, straight to the board, and then I just solder everything together. And wherever I don't use any 1 meg resistors or any standoffs that a lot of people talk about using, but I pretty much just build it wherever it needs to be soldered down the ground. And if I do need the odd pad or two, particularly for the input and output and the power supply and things like that, I bring it down to a pad. And then I actually use the nibbling tool to cut out my little board, so I always have lots of the pads hanging around.
Describe the circuit. How is it? How does it work, and how is it modulated?
Okay, it's based on it starts off with a 16.384 meg crystal, which is a common binary computer crystal. That's then multiplied up 9 times by 2 triplers, and then the final tripler and the final output stage are collector modulated, basically with a pass transistor that's biased to about mid rail, and then it swings up and down from there. There's a simple audio amplifier for the actual microphone. And I'm using a telephone insert here because I didn't
like
have
a carbon
insert. it's an old-fashioned receiver, but it makes the audio a little thin, but it's not too bad.
Right, okay. That sounds good.
But we can take it across the room if you like.
Well, we actually know that it goes about 5 kilometres, so that's great. Excellent.
Well, I'm Mike, the VK2BMR, and I've got my new power SWR meter. So it uses 88307
longitudinal.
Well, they're the logarithmic chips, so they convert sort of basically RF signals into power. It gives you an output voltage directly proportional to the power.
I've heard about this on the Solder Smoke podcast, and apparently they're quite sensitive at the low end.
It goes down to sort of minus 71 dBm sort of thing. So, and the top end's about 19. I mean, there's a little bit of sort of matching in there, so it's slightly more sensitive, but only by a few dBm normally.
Right.
But I was using the circuitry from the QST magazine, where they basically got a better response up to 500 megahertz. It was a flatter response just by putting a little bit of matching. You lose a tiny bit of sensitivity.
Right.
And I've got two, and the other channel I've actually put an attenuator in, so I can use the two together to form an SWR meter.
Right.
In conjunction with the directional coupler.
Okay, external directional coupler.
Yep. So the less sensitive channel reads the forward power, and the more sensitive channel the reverse power sort of thing.
Right. And this does the calculation for displaying the SWR?
Yeah, so there's a PIC microcontroller.
Right.
And it gives you a readout in each channel in dBm. I've converted to millivolts and in nanowatts, etc.
All right, great. Thanks, Peter, and thanks for all the guys there at the New South Wales group. We look forward to hearing from you in the future. Keep us posted on your projects. And, hey, if there are any other groups like that out there that would like to send in a similar contribution, just go ahead and do it. Record some interviews, have whatever you like, whatever you think would be of interest to the homebrew solder smoke community. And about 10 minutes is about right, I guess, so you can go a little bit longer, a little shorter if you like, and send it to me, and we'll work it into the show. I think people really will be interested in hearing what's going on with homebrew and QRP clubs around the world. So again, thanks, Peter, and thanks to everybody in that club. Uh-oh. That might require some compression. Overdid it a little bit. It's really hard. It's hard to hit it just right. I mean, and I'm looking at sort of a kind of an oscilloscope track here on Audacity as I record this, so I can tell whether I hit it too hard or hit it too weak. That one was over the top, gang. I think I'll have to really be careful about running the compressor. I don't want to cause any car accidents in South Dakota or anything like that. All right. Solder Smoke Mailbag. I got some good mail this week. Got one from Steve, his call sign. And now, this is a blast from the past. Call sign, WN0PWK. I'm sorry to report that this novice call expired some 40 years ago, gentlemen. Yep, most of us, I think, went through that kind of 1 year of novicehood. I remember living in fear that I would not learn what I needed to learn to pass the general, and I would slip from the ranks of radio amateurs into the ranks of the unlicensed, and perhaps even, perish the thought, the CB radio operators. But, you know, some of us got busy with other things for a variety of circumstances. A lot of guys just didn't upgrade during that 1 year, and Steve was one of them. But now he reports, and we're real happy to report this, that Solder Smoke has rekindled his interest, and after a 40-year gap, he is moving to upgrade. That's the kind of news we really like to get here on Solder Smoke. Steve sends us, he was listening to my description of the need for a current limited power supply, and he talks about some really hazardous electrical adventures as a kid, in which he used a toaster as a current limiting device on a homebrew arc light experiment involving carbon rods from D cell batteries. You guys know what Steve's talking about here. We're not going to present the details here. We may have some some liability issues to worry about on projects like this, so we'll just leave it at that. But thanks very much, Steve, for letting us know that Solder Smoke has put you back on the path towards general or higher class license status in ham radio. Great, good luck to you. Let us know what happens. We also got a really nice email from Dov, AD0V. Cool call sign there, Dov, in Brooklyn. Appropriately enough, Dov comments on Richard Feynman, another Brooklynite. Dov mentions that he picked up the book, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, about Feynman's adventures. And in that book, I think I mentioned this on Solder Smoke, but in that book there's a chapter about how young Richard Feynman set up essentially a little business repairing radios, repairing simple broadcast radios when he was a kid. And the book describes the troubleshooting process that Feynman would use, you know, with, you know, minimal or no test gear to figure out why these little simple superhead, I guess they were superheads, probably AC5, American Classic 5-tube superheads, weren't working. And I think one of his siblings or one of his friends was remarked that essentially Feynman, you know, fixed the radios with his head, which is, of course, what true troubleshooting really comes down to, as we all know. Dov commented on that. And then he also went on to describe and talk about some additional uses that the power meter that we're discussing can be put to. I think we've been referring to the power meter as the W7ZOI power meter, and Wes has pointed out that that's really unfair, because there were two designers there, Bob Larkin. It's also as much his project as it is Wes's. So henceforth, we will refer to this as the power meter or the QST power meter. You guys know what we're talking about, but certainly didn't want to leave Bob out of that, out of getting the credit for that great piece of test gear. Anyway, Dov describes an article in QRP Quarterly that discusses how to put the meter to some additional uses. He said it's in the last issue or the issue before that of QRP Quarterly. So I'll be taking a look at that, and I encourage you guys to do the same thing. On the subject of the power meter, Seth, W8FG, writes in and is happy to report that rumors of the log chips, the logarithmic amplifiers being used in the power meter being in short supply are incorrect, that they're still readily available. And in fact, this is important, Seth points out that they're still distributing free samples on these chips. So anybody who's interested in building one of these really, really useful pieces of test gear, keep that in mind. Apparently, the manufacturer of the chips is still giving out free supplies. Finally, we get a really nice email from Dennis, KC0, IFQ, and the subject is self-assembling circuits. It says, "Oh no, Bill, I think I have just experienced the self-organizing circuit phenomenon." You guys will recall this is something I mentioned a while back, that sometimes some of these projects just seem to build themselves. You know, you suddenly look at the junk box and through some miracle of electronics or some intervention by the radio gods, all the parts that you need, even including all the really obscure parts, have somehow made their way to your test bench, your workbench. And this was the case with my power meter. I said the thing practically built itself. Anyway, Dennis goes on. "While I was looking at a circuit designed by Dave Bixler, W0CH, a cute little end-fed tuner for 40 and 20 meters, it dawned on me that I could use the Dan Talo SWR indicator that we got free at OzarkCon in a building class. Then I remembered I had a box just like Dave used, so I went to retrieve it, and lo and behold, a package of red-black banana plugs were right beside it in the drawer. Oops! On the other side of the box was the Doug Hendricks toroid kit with wire. Wow! Now I'm waiting for three little switches to appear in front of me, but it may be better just to look for them. I suspect that the phenomenon is a result of the junk box reaching critical mass." It sounds like that to me, Dennis. Yep, sometimes it happens. It also happened to me when I was building the Made for the Mighty Midget receiver. Little did I know that over there in the corner, slowly but surely, the junk box was reaching critical mass and I would be required to build that tube-type receiver. All right, guys, that wraps it up for the week. The Audacity screen shows me at about 42 minutes. And so I guess 52 with the contribution from New South Wales. Thanks very much. Hope you enjoyed the show. Keep on listening. Send us feedback. And have a good week. 7-3 to the big group from London.